This hour, we're talking about traveling by book. And our next story takes us back in time to 1873, to the continent of Africa, and the death of the famous explorer, Dr. David Livingstone. Petina Gapa is the author of our story. She's a writer from Zimbabwe who's been obsessed with Dr. Livingstone since she was about 10 years old. She spent years researching the history, and in her new novel, Out of Darkness, Shining Light, she tells the story not of what happened when Dr. Livingstone was alive, but of what happened after he died. Specifically, what happened to his body. Here's how it begins.
This is how we carried out of Africa the poor, broken body of Bwana Daudi, the doctor, David Livingstone, so that he could be borne across the sea and buried in his own land. For more than 1,500 miles from the interior to the western coast, we marched with his body, from Chitambo to Mwanamuzungu, from Chisalamala to Kumbakumba, from Lambalamfipa to Tabora, until, 285 days after we left Chitambo, we reached Bagamoyo, that place of sorrow, whose very name means to lay to rest the burden of your heart.
Ah, that is wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And this is such a great story. I mean, of course, this really happened. But why did you want to turn this into a novel? And specifically, what happened to Dr. Livingstone's body after he died?
Well, his companions, his African companions, the men that he was traveling with, were faced with this great question of what to do with the bodies. He died in the interior of Africa, in what is now northern Zambia, and the coast was miles away. So they then had to make a decision, do we bury him here, or do we take him to the coast and have him shipped off to England for burial? And that decision was a momentous decision both for them, for Dr. Livingstone's family and friends, and for the continent of Africa. And so I wanted to write this story, but I wanted to write it from the perspective of the companions because we've never really heard their story being narrated by them.
And why didn't they just bury the body where he died? Why take on this huge, momentous, arduous journey all the way to the coast?
That was actually the question that preoccupied me the most as I was researching this book. Why on earth did they do this extraordinary thing? Because I remember this was in pre-Christian, pre-colonial Africa even. So there would have been a lot of superstition and unpleasantness when they tried to carry this dead body through these different villages and towns. It really was quite an extraordinary thing to do.
It's such an incredible story because this was a 9-month journey. There were 69 people, Africans, in this caravan from the interior of Africa all the way to the coast. And I can only imagine, I mean, what that kind of journey was like in the year 1873 in this very tropical environment, going across all kinds of lands controlled by, you know, various different local people. It sounds just incredibly difficult.
Yeah, not only in different groups of local people, but there were also slave traders amongst them. So in fact, they could have taken a much more direct route to the coast. They could have traveled in a straight line to the coastal town called Kilwa. But Kilwa, on the east coast of Africa, was a major slave trading port. So they didn't want to risk traveling along the same path as slave traders, because of course that would have endangered them. So they took this long, circuitous route. So it was an incredibly dangerous journey. And as I narrate in one of the chapters, there was a lot of hunger, there was a lot of weariness, and at one point they actually had to overrun a town in order to find food and shelter.
So they basically had to conquer
exactly
with their weapons.
It was an act of conquest. It was an act of conquest.
Wow. So just a very practical question. How did they transport a dead body for 9 months in tropical heat? Why didn't it just decompose?
Well, what they did with the body, I have great fun in the chapter in which I narrate how they prepared the body for burial. In fact, I was saying to someone earlier that I unleashed my inner Stephen King because they eviscerated the body. They sort of took out all his organs, his lungs and his heart. Now, in the Victorian imagination, it was his heart that was buried. So, you know, there were all these statements about they buried his heart in Africa, sort of like it was this wonderful act a very beautiful ceremony, but it was actually a very ugly thing because effectively they had to eviscerate him, take out all the insides, because then they laid out his body to dry. And in fact, I sometimes call this novel the Livingstone jerky novel because they effectively made him into jerky, into what we in Zimbabwe call biltong, which is dried meat. So they dried him on one side and then they dried him on another until, you know, after 10 days, he had completely dried out. And it was a fairly straightforward process because he was now a very small man by the end of his life. And then what they then did was quite funny. They folded him in half at the waist, right? They disguised him as a package for trade. Because, of course, they couldn't afford to look mournful. And so in this incredibly long cottage, they couldn't afford to look mournful or sad. So they acted as though they were just an ordinary trading party.
I can imagine that a lot of the local people, if they had heard there was this dead white man who was being transported through their land, I mean, that would have really spooked them.
So they were just, you know, moving along with their bells and their songs and, you know, da-la-la-la-la, we're just carrying along this package. What body? What body? This is not a body. This is a package for trade, you know. So it was a really bizarre theater. And they had to pretend all the time that the thing that they were carrying was actually not a dead person at all, but a few beads here and there, a few cloths here and there.
So we're talking about historical legacy here. And I would assume there's a very different history told by Europeans who celebrate Dr. Livingstone. I mean, you know, they think that great 19th century explorer, as opposed to many Africans. But is he considered an example of European imperialism or not?
That's such a great question, Steve. And it's a complicated one because that history really isn't being taught anymore in Europe. And in fact, in Berlin last week, I argued that they should teach that history again. They should teach the history of Europe in Africa because what you consider to be the European past really is Africa's present. So that act of drawing up and carving up a continent, drawing those borders, you know, those extraordinary straight lines on the countries of Africa, they were drawn with rulers because they were borders that were determined on the basis of geographic coordinates around a table in Berlin by Bismarck and the other European powers. Now, David Livingstone is an interesting one because he wasn't central to the actual colonization. He wasn't like Stanley, who basically colonized the Belgian Congo on behalf of the King of Belgium. And he wasn't like Mungo Park in West Africa. David Livingstone was before colonization, before the scramble for Africa. But what he did was to give a moral dimension to the mission of colonization, the whole Christianizing the continent, the whole ending the slave trade. That was the moral dimension that was given to say, we need to colonize these people for their own good. I don't know if you know your Kipling, but Rudyard Kipling wrote a very famous poem about why the United States should go into the Philippines, take up the white man's burden, you know. So that was the sort of the impetus to colonialism, the psychological explanation behind it. Take up the white man's burden, act like Livingstone, colonize and civilize the savages. So in a sense, he was not himself an imperialist, but he was certainly, in his death, an agent of imperialism. At the same time, it's then complicated by his role in the slave trade, by ending the slave trade and also by bringing Christianity to Africa. So you find that in many African countries, all the monuments that carry his name are still there.
Really? I mean, so there are a lot of monuments around Africa to Dr. Livingstone.
To this day, you know, the capital city of Malawi is Blantyre, after the city where Livingstone was born. Zambia has a city called Livingstone, right at the Victoria Falls, which he claimed to have discovered. But of course, you can't really discover a place where people are living, you
right.
know? And even Victoria Falls, the falls themselves, as well as the city in Zimbabwe, we still have those names that David Livingstone gave to this great waterfall. I went to Cambridge on a Livingstone scholarship. I was a Livingstone scholar at Cambridge. So he's very much still part of the conversation in a way.
See, I know you have been obsessed with the story of Dr. Livingstone for years, years and years. Why? What was it about the story that stayed with you all this time?
It was that body. It was that Chuma and Susie carrying the body thing, because I'd been reading about it since I was 10 or 11 years old. I first read the Livingstone book. It was a Lady Bird book that all Commonwealth children read. There was this picture, and I remember it vividly, this picture of Livingstone kneeling at his bed. And then the next page was his faithful companions, Susie and Chuma, carried his body for 9 months. so that he could be buried in England. And then when I went to secondary school at the age of 16, I traced out Livingstone's journeys in my history book, because to understand the history of Zimbabwe and Malawi and Zambia, you need to understand Livingstone's journeys. And still there was that line again, his faithful companions, Susi and Chuma, carried his body. And I kept asking myself, what an extraordinary thing to do. It's exactly the question you asked me earlier, Steve. You know, why on earth did they do it?
So I have to ask, what's your take on Dr. Livingstone? I mean, is he someone you admire?
I don't think I admire him. I think I like him, and I pity him, and I think I understand him. I understand obsession, and I understand people who are driven, and I prefer to deal with people who are flawed. He was not an evil man. I'm very uncomfortable dealing with evil, but I can deal very well with flaws. He was a deeply, deeply conflicted and tortured man. He had a wellspring of kindness in him, but also an incredible arrogance.
This novel strikes me as part of a kind of a larger project that so many African writers and intellectuals are part of. How do you retell this old story, 19th century history, for instance? This is the pre-colonial period, but it would apply to the colonial era as well. I mean, how do you tell that from an African perspective? Do you consider yourself to be part of this larger project?
I absolutely do, and I'm so glad that you recognize, because I think it's part of a decolonization project. I would love to see more Livingstone novels and more novels about this particular era, because I think the more we have of this, the better it is. It's like Americans with the Civil War. I mean, how many Civil War novels have there been? I mean, Margaret Mitchell is just one, but there are also novels by Black authors and by women authors. I recently saw The Beguiled with this Sofia Coppola film, which I absolutely loved. I'd never really thought about the Civil War from the perspective of women. I believe that the more we have different perspectives on the same historical facts and events, I think the richer our understanding of this history is. So I'm very excited to be part of a broader group of writers from my continent who are sort of like writing back, you know, the empire writes back.
That's Petita Gapa talking with Steve Paulson. Hey, remember I said we often end interviews by asking writers about their favorite book? Here's hers.
Hello, I'm Petita Gapa, the author of Out of Darkness, Shining Light. I would like to talk about one of my favorite novels, which is Persuasion by Jane Austen. I read Persuasion almost every year. Sometimes I call it my toothbrushing novel. It's a book that I read and that I can pick up at any time. I can even just pick up Persuasion and start reading from the middle, from the beginning, from the end. It doesn't matter. It's a novel I know intimately and that I love very much, because it's a different kind of love story, especially for Jane Austen to have written. Her love stories are usually about first encounters, people meet, fall in love, a few obstacles, and then they marry. Persuasion is very much a novel about a mature love, because it's a story of two people, Anne Elliot and Frederick Wentworth, who meet when they are young and then are separated by 8 years, and then they have to discover whether there are still these strong feelings that they have for each other and whether the obstacles that separated them in the first place are still as strong as they are 8 years later. It's a book of great sorrow and reflection. Anne Elliot is a very unusual heroine for Jane Austen as well, because she has great interiority. She's very different from Emma or Elizabeth Bennet, who are bubbly and lively. Anne is very much in her own thoughts, and Jane Austen really takes us in a very moving way into the deep, disappointed thoughts of this woman who thinks that love has passed her forever. This book is really, it speaks to me very powerfully, because it's a book about second chances. And as somebody who has made more than a few mistakes in their love life, I really hope that, second chances, third chances, fourth chances will come to me one day. But, you know, less frivolously, it's a book that I think is the most African of Jane Austen's novels. I always try to give an African reading to Jane Austen, and I think this and Emma are the two most African novels, because I can relate to Anne Elliot's dilemma as a young woman who wants to please her patriarchal and authoritarian family, but does so at the cost of her own feelings and her own heart.